What's up, everyone, and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, where we cover how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm your host, Mike DeSebato, and this week we have two stories for you. First, we're going to discuss the systemic shift that was behind the just-averted massive railroad strike in the U.S., and then we discuss large institutional asset owners and their importance for the push toward net zero. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Stay tuned. We start today with some big news that dropped the morning of this recording, and it's that one of the largest strikes of railroad workers since 1992 in the U.S. was averted after freight rail companies and unions representing tens of thousands of workers reached a tentative agreement, and talks went on late into the night last night. The agreement is headed to the union for ratification vote, so it's not complete yet, but as of this recording, it has prevented a massive, economically crippling strike from proceeding throughout the U.S. The possible damage of the strike was so bad that the U.S. presidential administration had sent Labor Secretary Martin J. Walsh to help broker a deal between management and labor, and President Biden personally called into the talks to thank the parties for reaching a deal around 9 p.m. last night. The administration was rightly spooked about a possible strike. The rail industry, the freight industry of the rail industry, controls a third of U.S. freight, and the U.S. already finds itself, like many others, in a somewhat continual post-COVID economic crisis. Now, these talks have been going on for some time between the railroads and its unions. The perfidious COVID wreaked havoc on the entire transportation industry, and rail workers, who are represented by some of the most active unions in the U.S., had either been furloughed or asked to take a pay freeze or both, all while dealing with the danger of working throughout a pandemic. And then as the economy opened back up in the U.S., the rail companies tried to scale up quickly, and it seems haphazardly, and the unions felt the companies didn't do enough to help the workers they relied on during the pandemic, and so said, look, we're going to strike if you don't do something. So that's sort of the news recap. And now what I want to do today for this show is to discuss the deeper ESG backdrop as to why this strike occurred, because it is a paradigm of the larger labor issues our economy is facing in the post-COVID world. And as my co-host and guest this week, Bentley Kaplan, told me, one of the structural problems that the industry is facing that allows for me to talk about this paradigm is due to a new rail operating company system that's called Precision Scheduled Railroading. And it is the brainchild of a since-passed CEO named E. Hunter Harrison.
His view was there was a lot of slack in how railroads were operating. So what he wanted to see was as many trains full as often as possible. So instead of having what they called a hub and spoke model, which was a sort of more localized way of running these railroads, he sort of suggested that they build bigger, longer trains that have fewer of these intermediate collection points, and therefore they'll increase sort of their profit efficiency, so how much they are making from the amount of trains they have available. But one of the upshots is that you need, in theory, fewer workers to run those systems, so that also reduces their costs, which if you're looking at it from a financials perspective is good. But there were some drawbacks. So, obviously there was dissatisfaction with the layoffs. And then there were arguments made against this model because it potentially reduced safety as well. So there were, fewer workers around, which meant fewer people overseeing things like, railroad safety, but then also, workers getting more tired, having to do more overtime. So it's a messy area in terms of debate and argument, but that's definitely at the heart of this sort of current impasse between freight railroads and their workforce.
There are about 9 U.S. domiciled railroad companies that we cover, and most have average to above average labor management scores by our assessment. There are 2 outliers to that, though. There's XPO Logistics and Union Pacific, who have below average labor management scores. And it's interesting for Union Pacific, which is one of the largest rail companies that we cover. Union Pacific has well disclosed and robust employee benefits, but they have been struggling with, as Bentley wrote back in December of 2021, potential morale risks due to fewer but longer trains, which have to be in a precision scheduled railroading system, and headcount reductions. They've seen a 17% year-over-year decrease in 2020. Union Pacific has also been dealing with employee lawsuits, including those that allege retaliatory actions have been taken against them by Union Pacific after they've done things like called in sick for work. And this can be a precursor, all these things, to labor issues, especially when 85% of your workforce is covered by a union, as is for Union Pacific. And of course, when you have a union, you have a voice for better bargaining over pay and benefits, and you get into this clash where you're saying you want this, but the company is saying, no, you already have enough of that.
One of the arguments the companies make is that these railroad workers are being paid a wage premium. So compared with a worker of similar skill and experience in the broader US, they're receiving, you know, percentages above that average salary. So that's one of the points the railroad companies are making. But you know, the unions have got a different view of that, and that's obviously that there is demand for the skill, and potentially, as you are seeing, workers not coming back from furlough, these companies are actually now finding it difficult to hire enough railroad workers, which is affecting their service delivery, which is a whole other issue as well. So, you know, there's an interesting sort of feedback mechanism at play.
That feedback mechanism has been disrupted by the long hours that precision scheduled railroading has required of its workers. A more efficient system that comes at the cost of a larger workforce can mean the remaining workers are more important than ever, and the companies have little ability to deal with things like, say, getting COVID or having a life outside work. The complications caused by this labor gets cut so we are more efficient dynamic has been seen in other markets in the US, such as retail and the food services industry. And so what is someone to do? If this stuff is systemic, it's all over our economy, a lot of different companies are out there, what should you look for to see if there's going to be long-lived disruptions due to labor issues, or whether a company may face disruptions, sure, but they will likely be shorter lived. Well, it's a factor that is important in all relationships, whether it's company to employee, employee to company, or partner to partner, and that is communication.
Even though these companies have got pretty good labor management programs or basic benefits, this combination of working in railroads and in areas where unions are very active creates very, very high risk exposure. So in some ways, this is a risk you almost can't manage out. This kind of strike is going to happen. But what you really want to ask as an investor is, are the relations with employees good enough that this is going to be a standard negotiation? Or is this going to be a situation where, you know, it's a question of who's going to blink first before there's a huge economic shutdown?
And so what we're seeing in the US is basically a loss of communication between worker and management. And it's seen in stark relief for the railroad industry, where there's such little middle ground that we need a US presidential administration to step into a situation that has seemed to be looming for a long time. There are certain participants in the financial markets that have more weight than others. There's you, me, your weird friend. We are individual asset owners, retail investors. The big dogs out there, though, are groups like pension funds, religious organizations, insurance companies, foundations, and some others that make up the world of institutional asset owners. These groups control large swaths of the market capitalization. Some estimates put them at around 59% of the global market as of 2020. And instead of that 59% being spread out into millions of different individuals, institutional asset owners have trustees and fiduciaries that help direct these large swaths of capital via investment strategy policies that have the ultimate goal of asset growth. And the timeline for that asset growth is based on an institutional timeline, one that thinks in centuries, not decades, like the retail investor. This means that climate change has a unique set of pressures on asset owners. A 2050 outlook is more important for them, relatively speaking, than for us. That being true, the push for institutional asset owners to transition their portfolios toward net zero is a more valid one than ever before. Remember, net zero is cutting greenhouse gas emissions to as close to zero as possible, with any remaining emissions reabsorbed from the atmosphere by carbon sequestration or carbon capture and storage or the like. So for an institution, getting to net zero would mean getting the companies you invest in, your hundreds of billions of dollars of investments, to start decarbonizing their operations where possible, as soon as possible. So if you're listening to this and thinking an institution might seem like a far-off thing because you are, in fact, an individual and not a body, but your money is likely part of an institution already. A bank, for example, is an institutional asset owner. A pension fund, if you're so lucky to still be able to be part of one, is an institutional asset owner. And their size and control of the market's capitalization also means the market feels where they shift their assets. And companies do really care about institutional investors. Sure, they care about retail investors as well, but we are a disorganized bunch. You remember that story about the activist investor that took seats on Exxon's board? Well, that was because they had the backing of two of the largest pension funds in the world. The California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, which has $442 billion US dollars in assets, and the California State Teachers Retirement System, or CalSTRS, which has around $305 billion in assets under management. So it's good to know where these institutional asset owners might move and why they're moving there. And my guest today and colleague Sylvain Vanston has recently written a publicly available asset owner's guide to getting to net zero. So I called him up and I asked him, let's say all institutions decide that climate change is such a big deal that they need to transition their portfolios to net zero tomorrow. How might they start that first step? How might they set targets for their portfolios and in doing so, pressure the companies that they invest in?
You can talk about climate ambition, climate strategy, defining a climate policy in general aspirational terms for some time, but very quickly you realize that you have to set yourself a quantitative target. That means a baseline, a specific target, and how to get there. Nowadays, most climate targets, at least the ones that we're seeing that are the most sophisticated, the most relevant, are typically along the lines of net zero by 2050. That means you want to achieve a situation where you will have very significantly reduced your financed emissions by 2050 and offset the rest. But because 2050 is still a fairly distant horizon, most asset owners also come up with intermediate targets, so like 2025 or 2030. This forms also the basis of the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance's so-called target setting protocol.
The Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance represents around $10 trillion in assets under management, so they're quite large. And here's what its protocol wants institutional asset owners to do. They want them to set engagement targets for the most pollutive companies in their portfolios. Then they want to set those targets by sectors, because institutional asset owners own a lot of different sectors, because if you have billions in assets under management, you have to spread it around to minimize concentration risk. The protocol also asks institutional asset owners to set yearly incremental emissions targets, a 22 to 32% reduction by 2025, and a 49 to 65% reduction by 2030, and so on. And of course, they would like these institutions to continually report on their progress to meet their targets as well. This is all about the process of setting your target, so making the plan. Once the plan is made, as a large institution, what do you do next? What are you doing the day after making the plan? What is your next move?
So what happens once you've decided on a target, especially if you have a fairly short time frame for your intermediate target? You need to act pretty quickly because the decarbonization curve for net zero is pretty steep. And so any day lost is going to be regretted. So you need to identify the most carbon-intensive assets in your portfolios. So obviously, that is a very important starting point. What do you do with them? Are they hopeless? By hopeless, I mean, are they responding to engagement year after year or not? Are they operating in a business or on products where there's actually no low-carbon alternatives? Are they operating in a region where they might have a little bit more carbon budget, for example, in emerging markets versus developed economies? Or are they actually transitioning quite strongly despite having a strong carbon intensity today? By all this, I mean mechanically getting rid of high carbon intensive issuers in your portfolios is probably not the best option. This is not the smartest way to proceed. This is what people might call paper decarbonization. So you need to take into account forward-looking metrics. You need to take into account commitments by those issuers. And for those where you think there's still margins for maneuver, then it's all about shareholder engagement.
What Sylvain is saying there is you need to conduct some sort of due diligence, see if the companies you own are actually living up to their plans. You use climate metrics, or you call up these companies and engage with them, things like that. And okay, fair, we're making this all sound very easy. And if you have an institution that is run by a sovereign that is in turn run by a king, these sorts of moves are easy. But if you aren't in said autocratic situation, there can be hurdles for institutions to move. You are managing the money of sometimes millions of individuals that need this money to retire in a couple of decades, hopefully. Institutions as a whole do have long timelines, as I noted, but their beneficiaries do not. So let's go through a couple of challenges that institutional asset owners might have to deal with.
Obviously, the first hurdle is quite simply to decide to have a net zero strategy. That means building a business case, get it approved. That requires understanding climate science. It requires understanding systemic issues. It's not so easy. That's one of the first checklist items. People need to understand the merits and the limitations of metrics. They need to start measuring. So, you know, what's weighted average carbon intensity about? What's implied temperature about? What does it do? What does it not do? Why is it important to think about the PCAF, the work of the Portfolio for Carbon Accounting Financials, and the Greenhouse Gas Protocol? That is very important. Asset owners would also be much better off working together rather than doing this on their own. And the good news is that there's a lot of organizations that bring asset owners or asset managers together to think about those issues that are much broader, much larger. I mean, way too large to tackle for a single asset owner. Need to understand what the asset allocation on risk management implications of a net zero strategy will be, stress testing and so on. So all of these cannot be overlooked. They require work. Net zero is a lot of work.
Some other challenges for asset owners are transparency into measuring carbon emissions, especially as they work with external managers. They might not have visibility into, say, their private equity's carbon data. There can be inconsistencies in carbon accounting, which just adds to the need for better transparency around all this emissions data. But let me bring this all home, back to the individual, back to you, the heroic listener. Because like I said in the beginning, you might be still thinking, why should I care about all this? Well, the beauty of large bodies is that they are influenced by the individual that they serve or that makes them up. If you're YouTubing, go check out a CalSTRS meeting, for example. You will see teachers getting onto the mic and asking trustees why their assets are invested in companies that haven't yet set carbon reduction targets. Or you might be a college student or have a kid that one day wants to go to college, and you can see if their endowment, the colleges, has a policy which addresses some of these net zero issues. Or you might have insurance. And I want to stick with insurance for a second because it's both mundane and sort of interesting. Insurance companies are investors. They take the money you contribute and invest that money in equities and bonds and real estate and private equity, really anything. They do have to go through yearly reviews because, and here is the interesting part about the insurance industry, they have reserve requirements since they are one of the few entities that can make you a return promise. They promise to pay you $500,000 if you die, for example, and were lucky enough to take out a life insurance plan right before your untimely death, like I plan to. The regulation that covers how they invest their assets isn't important. What is important is because they have this general account with which they can invest all over the market, they can then make a net zero pledge for that account as well. And if you go to the UN Net Zero Insurance Members page, you will see what insurance companies have actually made that pledge. And unfortunately, for my American listeners, none of the insurance companies on the list are domiciled in the US. They're mostly European, with one Japanese and one South Korean company sprinkled in. So I will end with this. Go check out our Net Zero Asset Owner Guide on MSCI.com because it may impact you more than you previously had thought. And that's it for the week. I wanted to thank Bentley and Sylvain for talking to me about the news with an ESG twist. I want to thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. If you like what you heard, don't forget to rate and review us. That really helps and gets us more access to people all around the world. And if you want to hear us each week, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Bentley will be hosting next week, but I will talk to you the week after that.
The MSCI ESG Research Podcast is provided by MSCI Inc. subsidiary, MSCI ESG Research, LLC, a registered investment advisor, and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. And this recording and data mentioned herein has not been submitted to, nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. None of the discussion or analysis put forth in this recording constitutes an offer to buy or sell or promotional recommendation of any security, financial instrument, or product or trading strategy. Further, none of the information is intended to constitute investment advice or recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.